Blog Talk Radio.
And tonight we present a discussion on the relationship of ancient Canaanite mythology to Solomonic ceremonial magic. Now we'll begin by establishing the legendary biblical background of Solomon, the wizard king, and his mystical powers, his relations with Hiram of Tyre, the queen of Sheba, and his building of a temple to the goddess Astarte. And we will mention the Canaanite priest king Melchizedek, who anointed Abraham long before Moses, and we will mention the Masonic legend in this context and how Solomon united the Jews and the Canaanites to build his great temple. We will cover the Rosh Hashanah Ugarit Canaanite texts, their connection to the Holy Grail legend, and our own reconstruction of ancient Canaanite seasonal ceremonies. Then, the following week, we will present the conclusion of our reconstructed Canaanite legend, Prince Akkot and the Magic Bow. You heard the first part of it last week. So, tune in and get the inside story on King Solomon's magical religion. Now, first, I think we should kind of define our terms here and sort of figure out why Canaanite mythology and why are we doing this and sort of put this in context. As you all know, we are hermetic magicians and we specialize in that area of hermetic magic referred to as Solomonic ceremonial magic. Now, this is the reason why we call it Solomonic. It is because during the Middle Ages, Solomon was a favorite pen name for various writers who were writing books on ceremonial magic, how to do invocations and evocations. So where there was a series of Solomonic grimoires, if you want to call them that. The one, of course, that the most famous is the Key of Solomon, Greater Key of Solomon. And then the one that we're most influenced by is a collection of Solomonic grimoires called the Lamegata. And In these books on magic, Solomon is given he's like Merlin. He's like the Merlin of the Middle East, the Merlin of the Bible. He's the master magician. And quite frankly, he has a bigger reputation as a magician in the Quran, in the Islamic tradition, than he does in the Bible. But then he has a pretty good reputation as a magician in the Talmud. And regardless of that, the Islamic world very much influenced medieval magic anyway through Spain and with the Picatrix. And of course, we've talked about the Picatrix before, and as you know, that's a 9th century Arabic astrological magic grimoire And so the Arabian version of Suleiman, the wizard king, very much influences the medieval magicians. And so Solomon became the avatar of medieval ceremonial magic, especially the kind of magic where you have a circle and you have a triangle and you summon spirits and do all the kind of stuff that wizards are supposed to do. So if this is the case, then, and this is Solomon, you know, was a biblical king, so why are we delving into Canaanite mythology in relation to Solomonic magic? Well, there's a very good sound reason for that. And the reason is that Solomon delved into Canaanite mythology, the original Solomon, of course. And Solomon became, in his later years, a bit of a pagan. And he built a temple to Astarte and had a number of pagan wives that he built temples to. And he also had quite an affair with the Queen of Sheba, who was herself a magician and claimed to be descended from the jinn. And, of course, they are the creatures of fire, the pre-Adamic creatures of fire, anyway. So, and Solomon, supposedly, according to these legends, used these spirits that he summoned and controlled with his magic ring to help him build the great temple. Now, that's various Arabian and Talmudic legends to that effect. So, Solomon was very much involved with Canaanite religion, both through Hiram of Tyre, who helped him build the great temple, and we're getting into the Masonic thing a little bit here now, so we might as well cover that. The Masonic legend has it that Solomon wanted to build the great temple, and of course this is in the Bible, I mean, that he called upon Hiram of Tyre to help him build the great temple to God in Jerusalem. And Hiram of Tyre, being a Phoenician, of course, and he said, "Praise the Lord." Oh, well, okay, what Lord are we praising here? I don't think Hiram of Tyre meant to say praise YHVH, I think he meant to say praise L. And I believe he translated it that way. I think, I don't know whether that's translated that way in the Hebrew Bible or not, but it certainly should be translated that way. Praise L. And Solomon, probably, in all probability, was also a devotee of L. And whether or not the Jews at that time equated El with some version of Yah is not really known, because YHV didn't even exist at that time. That's a medieval formula anyway. And so essentially what Hiram of Tyre and his Phoenicians, his Canaanites, and Solomon and his Hebrews were doing was they were building a great temple to the God that they both worshipped, the Father God, the Father El. And I don't think you're going to find any serious scholar who's going to disagree with this. And even the Masons back in the early 1700s or the late 1600s when they came up with this, that's what they kind of thought. They didn't want to, you know, put it in so many words, because that would have been kind of heretical, but that's what they were thinking. So the idea here was, with the Masonic legend, that Solomon and Hiram of Tyre were going to get together, and they were going to build this temple to the one over God, the high God that they all worshipped. And the Phoenicians, of course, they had their lesser gods, which the Hebrews probably didn't worship, but they were going to have a temple to the tiger that they both countries, both nations, both cultures, they both worship. Universal God, the Most High God. Melchizedek's God, by the way, and Melchizedek was a priest king of El, and he was Canaanite. and he anointed Abraham. And that was a long time before Moses. So this whole Canaanite thing goes way, way back. And by the way, while we're mentioning that, we should say that three times in the Bible, I think Paul and whatever it is, says that Jesus was a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Yeah, but Melchizedek was not a priest of you-know-who. He was a priest of El. So what does that make Jesus? Anyway, and I don't think you'd find too many Christians that would disagree with that one either. What we have here in the Masonic legend is these two races, these two religions coming together. Now, much makes it interesting about the Masonic legend is that the great architect that both Hiram and King Solomon both teamed up with was Hiram Abiff, who happened to be, his mother was Jewish and his father was Phoenician. So he was a common man. And so Hiram Abiff represented the common man. And then we have these two kings. One king is a Hebrew and one king is a Canaanite. And then we have a common man, the architect, who's going to build this thing, who is of both races and both religions. Now, the people who put the Masonic legend together were certainly aware of what they were doing. And what this means is that when Hiram Abiff gets murdered by three workmen who want to have the secret word, Solomon and Hiram obviously know the secret word, but the secret word supposedly dies with Hiram Abiff. Well, how's that going to happen? Well, Solomon and Hiram both know it. How can it die with Hiram Abiff? Well, obviously it doesn't. It's just that the common people aren't ready for it yet. That's what it means. That's what's meant by that. Now, keeping all of this in mind, what did Hiram of Tyre, what was his religion? What was Melchizedek's religion several hundred years before that? What was this religion that is so important to Solomon's temple? It's important to Solomon's magic. It's important to ceremonial magic. It should be. I mean, very important to ceremonial magic. Why? Didn't we have it? Why all the way into the Renaissance, why didn't we have this? Why is it right now that we're having it? We didn't even have it before World War II. Well, there's a simple reason for that. The simple reason is that Canaanite mythology was a mystery. Nobody knew it. Nobody really knew what these people believed. We had some sources, I'll mention a couple of them, Sancho Niatho or Sancho Niathan, whichever way you want to spell it or pronounce it, was a Syrian, very, very Greek Syrian, who wrote a history of Phoenician theology, the origin of Phoenician theology and whatever, in about 500 B.C., and I'm not looking at my dates here right now, so I might be wrong, but it's about that time. And Sancho Niathan's, we had this, yeah, this is a rather short thing, but it covers the creation myths and all whatever of the Phoenicians, Canaanites. But it appeared to be so Greekified that most people thought, this is just some Greek's version of this. And so scholars didn't give it too much credence. Well, since World War II and since the archaeological discoveries made right before World War II and translated after World War II, we begin to realize that old Sancho Niathan actually was pretty close to the mark, and so now his work has come back into favor. But what we dug up the archaeologists dug up right before World War II on the coast of Syria, and the old city of Ugarit, which is right now in the village of Ras Imra, which I think just recently got bombed by Assad and his bully boys, but too bad. But anyway, at least I think we got most of the sacred tablets out of there before they bombed it. Anyway, the Ras Imra Library in Ugarit is around about 1400 B.C. Now, that's about the time of Melchizedek. Yep, uh-huh. At the time of the old priest king. Now, what Melchizedek means, by the way, for those of you who are curious, it means Balak Tzaddik. And those of you who have a little bit of Aramaic, you know that Balak is king and Tzaddik is priest. So Melchizedek just means priest king. So there could be a whole bunch of Melchizedeks. But anyway, this is around the time of Melchizedek. So this is the religion of Melchizedek, or at least very close to it. And what did these people actually worship? Well, fortunately, we dug up, the archaeologists dug up, a whole library of myths and myth cycles from which you can derive seasonal ceremonies, and the whole thing then came to light. And so we know what it was, and we can even have an idea of their cosmology, compare it with Sanchuniathan, and we can reconstruct it. But this did not get translated and didn't become available till the 1950s, and they were just beginning to get it then. So it really was only the 1960s and 70s before it really started to become available so we could really understand it. All right. Now, that means that right about the time we were founding the OTIE, the Order of the Temple of Astarte, just about that time, that's when this material was really becoming available in the libraries and all. Here we got the Order of the Temple of Astarte, and she's our patron goddess, and oh boy. My wife and ex-wife and I, we had been members of Fred Adams' Ferrofaria, which is an Eleusinian mystery recreation, and my wife said to me, she said, we got to have seasonal ceremonies too, and I said, well, yeah, we got this Tanite mythology that's just been uncovered, and so sure, we can do it. So we did them. And this is where, we really began to get the most out of this old religion that I'm sure, I am absolutely convinced, if these legends, the Canaanite legends, had been available back in the Renaissance or back in the Middle Ages, that they would have used the old Solomonic magicians, certainly would have used them. Now, one other thing I want to point out while we're talking about this is a book that relates to this and is very important when you're connecting Solomonic magic with the Canaanite myth cycle. And you're having, you have a biblical tradition, too, that you're having to accommodate. One of the things that's very, very important in all of this is a book by a lady anthropologist by the name of Jessie Weston. And she came out with this in 1920 in England. And it's called From Ritual to Romance. And what Jesse went on again, notice 1920, this is before the Ras Imra tablets were discovered. So she was basing, what she was basing her, was just fragmentary material, that some of it in Fraser's Golden Bough, and some little on Sanchuniathan, and mainly what she was deriving from Fraser's Golden Bough research she'd done. And there was, in Fraser's Golden Bough, a Syrian version, later version, of the Adonis story, which was the death of the Adon, the Lord, which was a later version of the death of Baal. And so Jesse Weston realized, of course, that the original goes back to at least 3,500 years. She knew that, but she had a later version of it. But she came up with this treatise from Ritual to Romance in which she traced the Holy Grail legend all the way back to Syria and all the way back to Canaanite, the later version of Canaanite mythology. And the way she did that, she realized it, was that up in the Lebanon, up in the mountains, there is a gorge, and then there's a cave. And out of this cave, there's a spring in the cave. And that creates a pool. Then there's a waterfall that spills from the cave, the sacred cave, down into the gorge. And then it runs down the river all the way to the sea. This is called the River Ebrum. Now, there's a hematite layer in the strata along the coast of the river, along the shores of the river. In the springtime, when the floodwaters are, you know, coming down, the water in the river flowing toward the sea rises up to the hematite layer, and the river runs red. And this is a natural phenomenon which is legendarily replicated or legendarily metaphorized in the idea of the year king dying, the yearly death of Adonis or earlier Baal. And Astarte, of course, mourns for him and whatever. And so as a result of this, there's a very, very ancient, I don't know if there's anything left of it, but there was a very, very ancient temple to Astarte up there at that gorge and in that cave. A very ancient temple, and every spring or whenever this actually happened, I don't know exactly the date when it happened, thousands of people would go up there, and when the river started going red, they would put flowers in the water and in the gorge and commemorate the death of the Ear King. This was called the Adonia, and it's the only seasonal ceremony the Canaanites that we're sure, absolutely sure of, and we have a name of. The rest of them we have to reconstruct from the Rosh Hashanah. But this carried on, was why Jesse Weston knew about it and used it to recreate the Holy Grail. She traced the Holy Grail legend all the way back to this. And this went on, and they kept doing this for thousands of years up until 300 A.D. when the Christians, nice, sweet, loving, peaceful Christians, raised a big mob and descended on these poor pagans and slaughtered them. And that was the end, and then destroyed the temple of Astarte, and that was the end of that. So this Jesse Weston equated this in this book, From Ritual to Romance, and that had quite an influence on me. And then when I read the Rosh Hashanah tablets, which she didn't have access to, here in one of these, it says that Baal, the Lord Baal, has this goblet, this huge goblet to awe mortal man and filled with golden liquor. And I realized that yeah, this is the original Holy Grail. So this certainly helped us out when we did our Adonia ceremony. So we were able to reconstruct. Now another way we could use using the Rosh Hashanah tablets and also using the Bible and biblical legends and all, we were able to reconstruct the Canaanite version of Ishtar's descent into the underworld. There's a Canaanite version of this, and guess what that became in later days? Salome's Dance of the Seven Veils. Yep, that was the Canaanite version of Ishtar's descent into the underworld. Now, yeah, so you're saying, well, wait a minute, I thought, Astarte is not Ishtar. Well, Astarte was the Canaanite counterpart of the Mesopotamian Ishtar or Inanna. Very, very close. In other words, they're what they call, the anthropological term would be cognate. And Astarte is also the inspiration for the Greek Aphrodite. So what you're seeing here, and this also is very interesting, I think we need to bring it up, Canaanite mythology is influenced primarily by what we think is earlier Sumerian mythology. The gods have pretty much the same attributes, and of course, as you recall, that Sumerian and Akkadian Assyrian pantheon, that's really where the Tree of Life, the structure of the Tree of Life as we have it, got started, was from the Tree of Life during the Jewish captivity. They got the idea from that Tree of Life and the gods, putting the gods on it. Where that came from. But Canaanite mythology was influenced by that structurally, and also very much influenced by both the Greek and the Egyptian at different times. The Phoenicians and the Canaanites were very, very eclectic. And they traded a lot. I mean, there's those Phoenicians, you know, traded all over the world. And they brought home ideas and artwork and all kinds of things from all directions. So Canaanite mythology took on an almost a universal quality to it. And one thing about it that is very, very good for us is that Canaanite mythology is not as harsh and not as capricious. It's not as sinister, really, as Mesopotamian philosophy, as Sumerian or Mesopotamian. The Canaanite gods are, you know, with a few exceptions, are pretty nice people, for gods. And it's much more positive in its cosmology, its approach, than the Sumerian or Babylonian mythology. And Father El, the father of the gods, he's about the only thing he does that's reprehensible is he gets drunk every so often, but he's married to the mother of the gods, Asherah of the sea, and she probably, you know, cleans up for him. I have a little section on this that I will read from our seasonal ceremony book, a little commentary on Prince of Cotton, the Magic Bow. Now, as you know, we ran the first about two-thirds of Prince of Cotton, the Magic Bow, which is our reconstruction, modernized reconstruction of one of the Canaanite epics. The other epic is King Kereth, which we will which we're already working on putting that into modern dress or modern style. And but Pritzker and the Magic Bow, we ran that last week, and we'll run the conclusion of it next week after, and with this commentary in between. Yeah, that'll be part two, and part two of Prince of Cotton, the Magic Bow. But right now we're gonna get you, you know, the commentary. So let me read a little bit of this commentary to you, because I think it kind of gets a good idea across of the Canaanite of the Canaanite mythology, and how it relates. Okay. And this is the first page and a half, so. Author's commentary on Prince of Khat and the Magic Bow. For a writer of romantic adventure stories to discover a forgotten Bronze Age epic like the Ugaritic Akkad, Son of Daniel, which has gone virtually unnoticed for almost 50 years since it was first unearthed and translated into modern language, is like finding buried treasure. Why has this remarkable tale, with its wrathful goddess, tragic hero, ruthless villain, and supernatural monsters, remained untapped as a literary source? Well, the answer to this question lies with the ancient culture that gave us the story. The Canaanites were the bad guys of the Bible. Well, were they not the perverts of Sodom and Gomorrah? Did they not throw newborn babies into the fiery belly of Moloch and force their daughters into prostitution in Astarte's temples? Well, if there is truth behind these biblical diatribes, it is highly distorted. Sodom and Gomorrah probably didn't have any more Sodomites than the tribe of Benjamin. And if you think I'm kidding there, you just read Judges chapter 19, 20, and 21. The Bible account of child sacrifices to fiery Moloch has been questioned by recent scholarship. Moloch may be a misreading of Malak, which equals king. And one might argue that a Hebrew nomad selling his pubescent daughter to another tribesman for a number of goats and sheep so that she could warm her master's bed and chew his sandal leather, along with his other so-called wives, is no worse than an urban Canaanite consigning his daughter to a pampered life as a temple dancer and a courtesan. Now, the ancient farming and city-dwelling Canaanites were a civilized people. Second millennium Canaan, although an Egyptian protectorate, had its own written language, literature, and Bronze Age technology. Canaan was the crossroads of the ancient world. In comparison, the Hebrew nomads of the same era were still in the Stone Age. We are conditioned from childhood to credit the Hebrew patriarch Moses with originating the concept of the one and only omnipresent, invisible, and universal God. Moses was an educated upper-class Egyptian in the years following Akhenaten. And he was probably capable of such a noble conception, but he opted for something more primitive. No salvation, no afterlife, and very little compassion. YHVH told Moses to, quote, place no other god before me, thus admitting that the other gods existed. And rather than being omnipresent, YHVH was fiercely territorial. He was not invisible. His holy ark was richly decorated and invoked as much fear and awe as any pagan idol. He was not universal. He was the exclusive God of the Israelites. And if the Christians had not borrowed him, he still would be. And on the other hand, El, or Latipan, the father god of the Canaanites, and possibly the god of Solomon and the 10 lost tribes of Israel, was no more territorial or exclusive than Olympian Zeus. He presided with Lady Ashurada of the Sea over all creation. He was compassionate and kindly rather than just and jealous. Father El did not meddle in human affairs, except to tumble a mortal wrench occasionally, much like his Olympian counterpart. And unlike the austere YHVH, he occasionally got falling down drunk perhaps because, unlike the perennial bachelor Yahweh, he was married to the mother of the gods, and she could clean up after him. Now, there are several parallels and even exchanges between Canaanite and Greek mythology. The Greek goddess Aphrodite is probably an imported version of Astarte, the earlier war goddess Anath, cognate with the Mesopotamian Ishtar, shares characteristics with Athena and the dangerous virgin Artemis, also with Kali and Durga and Vajrayogini. The psychic princess Pugat in our story plays a similar role to the Trojan Cassandra. Prince Baal, the cloud rider, is the Canaanite year king or green man, Tammuz in the Babylonian mythos, and later the Greek and Syrian Adonis, doomed to die each summer solstice when the streams dried up and the crops withered, and to be resurrected each fall or winter when the rains returned. And the ancient Greeks personified this seasonal vegetation cycle in the myth of Persephone and Demeter. As Fraser has demonstrated in the Golden Bough, this was a universal pagan theme. Ancient cults, such as the Eleusinian Mysteries in Greece and the rites of Baal and Astarte in Canaan, sought to attune their worshippers to the eternal life cycle of nature and the heavens. And as the late Joseph Campbell suggested, this was the still center point about which their universe revolved. In contrast, monotheistic religions proclaim a pseudo-historical timeline from creation myth to final apocalypse, and then celebrated alleged events in their mytho-history, which they conveniently assigned to the solstices and the equinoxes already hallowed by the earlier pagans. And now, let's point out something here that one of my colleagues back east who has a Canaanite group, and he tries to be closer to the ancient Canaanite tradition, perhaps, than we do. And he said, come on, Bunk. He said, they didn't do it on the solstices and the equinoxes. They did it in conjunction with the planting and the reaping, and the seasons according to their agriculture. And I said, well, sure, Steve. I said, you're probably right, and I think you probably are right. But what we've done is we have taken this into the Hermetic tradition, and we have taken it over to Alexandria and Alexandrified it. So having taken it over to Alexandria, Alexandrified it, which is very, very logical. I mean, why not? I mean, sure, everything else got taken over to Alexandria and Alexandrified, so why shouldn't we do this? So we needed to hook it up with the solstices of the equinoxes. That way we make it universal, and that way we really, really tie it to the heavens and link it to astrology. And this is the same thing, by the way, that the Christians did. I mean, after they stomped on the pagans and had all their anti-intellectual tirades that they had, then they proceeded to take the pagan secrets and this and the Hermetic tradition and everything and use as much of it as they could in Christianity. So we did the same thing. We took the old Canaanite seasonal ceremonies, now that we had them and we were able to reconstruct them, and took them and like they would be taken to Alexandria and like I said, Alexandrified. And then we want to leave a little bit further. And I've got to admit this now. I can read you a little bit of King Koret tonight, and you'll see what I mean about Canaanite mythology. In a sense, it's almost like Welsh triads. It goes in threes. Everything is repeated in three different metaphors. And this might be okay. This might be okay if you're really a good harpist. If you're really a good harpist and you got a good musical score with this thing, then that might work. But I tried reciting it one time, you know, just straight out as prose, and you just didn't, it just doesn't come across. Not as a drama, not as a drama or as a prose, a piece of prose. It just doesn't. So what we did with the Canaanite myths from the Rosh Hashanah, but the word myths, is we put them, Alexanderfied their cosmology, got that hermeticized, and then we did them kind of Renfrew style. In other words, as they would have been done had they survived, had these seasonal ceremonies survived all the way through to Elizabethan times, so that we could relate to them the way we enjoy St. George and the Dragon and John Barleycorn at the Ren Fair. Having done that, they're in rhyme, sure, but they're more accessible. And, you know, to give you an example of that, you know, we just try a little bit here. Let's see. Lady of the Field returns to the west, Lord of the Vine circles. Deuso returns to the east. Vine says, "We have searched the barren mountains, we have walked the dry parched plain. Not a rose nor dove we saw there, not a sign she comes again." And then Lady of the Field says, "Yet the sun and stars are reckoned on this high and holy place. At the eastern gate of sunrise, here we pray to see her face." Vine elevates the dagger and the incense boat serves the incense. "With the smoke of rose and sandal rising, we beseech thee to appear. Bring the grail from far Mount Saffon with El's blessing for the year." And Field says, "He who rode the clouds has fallen. He who brought the rains is dead. In his tomb beyond the sunset, past the seven gates of Tread." Vine says, "Come ye forth, O fair Astarte, lead us where thy consort lies. Make the journey girt for battle, so the Thunder Lord may rise." Now, this is accessible, but if the Canaanites, if you did this right straight from the Rosh and Ra text, it would not be as accessible. So we required a little to make it in Renaissance style, and of course take it to Alexandria and put it in the Hermetic cosmology, plug it into the Hermetic tradition. Now we are perfectly justified in plugging this into the Hermetic tradition. I'll tell you why. The Sabaeans over in Haran. Now, we've talked about these people before, and there is a kind of a relationship between the Sabaeans and the Canaanites. They certainly were familiar with each other and whatever. And the Queen of Sheba, of course, that was a very high civilization, and they were essentially very similar to the Canaanites. But the Sabaeans were star worshippers. And they worshipped essentially the same pantheon as the Sumerians and Assyrians, whatever. In fact, they claimed to be the preservers of the Babylonian religion and the star religion. And these Sabaeans, they kept going all the way up till 1200 in their city until finally the wells dried up and they had to leave. Then they dispersed and became the wizards for the caliphs of Islam, because they swung a deal and didn't have to convert to Islam because they had this big, long tradition. But they were hermetic. They adopted the hermetic treatises, and they adopted the hermetic system. And so, my gosh, if the Sabaeans can adopt the Hermetic system, well, why can't the Canaanites? And I mean, if we're going to do this, and so consequently, we feel perfectly justified in the Hermetic in absorbing this into the, so we can use it with Solomonic ceremonial magic, which is also Hermetic, and This means that we can take the Kabbalah, and this is another great thing, take the Hebrew Kabbalah, which has a lot to do with Solomon's ceremonial magic, take that Kabbalah and plug the Canaanite gods into it. And, you know, we dropped Yahweh out of it because we figured kind of he might not want to be there anyway, and you know, so we dropped him out and but the Kabbalah works just as well without him. I mean, you know, I'm sure there are people who don't think that's true, but it does. And so we have a perfect blend here for Solomon's magic, or the gods that Solomon himself was calling forth, which are the spirits, the genies, and all of that. And the Kabbalah, which of course works into medieval ceremonial magic, and the Hermetic system upon which they're all based, and we've managed to preserve the antiquity of Melchizedek's religion, but we've done it in a context that is entirely accessible, in one unified context. Now, I want to point out that all of this was developed before I ever became a Mason. And I knew, you know, and I didn't even, I really wasn't studying Masonic literature that much when we put this together. We put this together from the directions and the sources that pointed in our direction. And I only really, really fully realized later I was entered, passed, and raised in 1981. Yeah, so we started off our seasonal ceremony cycle in 1974. So consequently, this is not, as some people might think, some sort of heretical form of masonry. No, you know, it's not. It was all of this was in place before I ever became a Mason. But at that point when I became a Mason and became started going through the higher degrees and all of that, I began to realize just how much we dovetailed with masonry and how this had so much to do with Solomon, the Solomon's Temple legend. And so this was pretty satisfying thought, because masonry, as I'm sure all of you know, has had a tremendous influence on magic. And, you know, the Golden Dawn is you can't call it a Masonic organization, it's not, but it's certainly influenced by masonry, and it's on a Masonic, kind of a Masonic model. And in fact, all of the magic orders, the Aurum Solace claims that they're not Masonic. They say they're alchemical. All right, well, that'll be that. But the whole of magical orders are on Masonic model, and the Rosicrucian orders were reconstituted 100 years after the 30 Years' War. They were reconstituted on Masonic models. So masonry has an influence on ceremonial magic, and so this fits perfectly with that. And now, you know, I want to read a little bit here about the first seasonal ceremony we did, and this was the one this was actually Adonia was the first one. And this was 1974. You can see this not Adonia. I think the one we did was Seven Gates, the one on the video that we still have from back in 1974. But I'll read you. This was the first one we did. I'm going to read this out of the old seventh ray. On the warm summer evening of the 22nd of June, 1974, the Ordo Templi Astartes inaugurated its quarterly cycle of seasonal ceremonies with the outdoor presentation of the Adonia pageant at the Altadena Hermitage. The ceremony was exuberantly Dionysian, with all members and guests participating, followed by the traditional feast and convivial socializing. It was a time of good fun, happy reunions, and nostalgic reflections, all in keeping with the spirit of such an event. But let us not overlook the inner significance of the Adonia ritual itself. The importance of seasonal ceremonies and traditional magic cannot be underestimated. Looking beyond the philosophical and spiritual perversities of medieval monastic dualism, we must realize that the magic and Kabbalah were not separate from nature in Solomon's time. The vegetation cycle of Palestine, so similar to ours here in Southern California, forms the central theme of the Baal Astarte mythos, as first recorded in the ancient Rosh Hashanah tablets circa 1400 BC, a primary source of the Jewish calendrical festivals and especially the Christian Holy Grail legend, which is so vitally important to the Western esoteric mystique. Adonia derives from the Phoenician word Adon, Lord, more familiar in its Hebrew form Adonai, or in its Greek form Adonis, who, the reader will recall, was the tragic young mortal lover of Aphrodite. Adon is, of course, Prince Baal, son of El, and is, actually, he was the son of Dagon, but we're calling him the son of El there, and I think I'll make that correction, and is the Ur King, or Green Man, who brings the spring rains, the nectar, the soma, or the dew of heaven. Invocation was, yearly king of fruitful furrows, dripping clouds of leaden gray, tree-born lord of leafy raiment, sired by golden solar ray, thee we hail with scented myrrh and old Cinnerus, sacred way. Come to us from far Ithacus, spring and shrine and sacred tree, where roses bloom by lofty cedars, and a crimson river seeks the sea. Call we forth, Lord Baal, the Ur King, rain cloud rider, prince of earth. Pour for us the dew of heaven, holy straw of life and birth. And Baal answers his invocation, appearing with his golden goblet, the original Holy Grail, which he delights in serving to the dancers who circle his sacred edge until the cup is empty, thus symbolizing the end of the rains. The sun has just passed its yearly zenith, becoming a fierce destroyer where before she was a warm benefactor. And then, with the beating of an ominous drum, Baal's sinister brother, Moat, lord of death and king of the dismal underworld, arrives with his sickle to kill the now helpless green man. The mourners then invoke Astarte, Prince Baal's eternal consort. Queen of Heaven, Fair Astarte, Mistress of the Evening Star, Wayborn Goddess of Morning, hear us in the land afar. Come to us on white wings gliding, come to us on crested foam. Bring to us thy love supernal from thine emerald palace home. Heed our call, O Fair Astarte, consort of our dead Prince Baal. Lift the curse of Moat upon us, shield us from the fire of Saul. Grace the land with milk and honey, save the seedlings in the earth. Give us hope for all the future, grant us love and life at birth. Astarte descends and promises them that she will journey to the underworld in the autumn season and defeat Moat and resurrect Baal. And she blesses the participants as they burn petals of the blood rose and sprinkle the fallen green man with the water of her tears. And so the ceremony is concluded, a time of purification to precede new beginnings. And with the coming of autumn equinox and the celebration of the Festival of Seven Gates, we will indeed inaugurate a new beginning, for Prince Baal will be brought back to life in the sacred precincts of the OTA's newly acquired and considerably improved permanent temple headquarters facility, that's over in Pasadena. Although our cycle of seasonal ceremonies is distinctly Hermetic Kabbalistic and based on parabiblical mythology, we should certainly credit Farfaria for invaluable inspiration and their gift of the original wood henge. Of course, we had Fred's old wood henge over in Pasadena. And we owe considerable thanks to the noted ethnic dance choreographer, Shelley Applegate, for developing and directing this vital aspect of the pageant. Shelley's passed away now. He was an expert in English country dancing, all pony dancing, no Morris dancing and all of that. The kind of dancers you saw in the Wicker Man. By far, the greatest mysteries of magic are to be found in the deep structural relationships between symbolic and mythological correspondences. Salome's Dance of the Seven Veils is a reenactment of Ishtar Astarte's descent into the underworld, but the Grail itself is perhaps the key to the greatest mystery of all, deriving from the yearly death of the young vegetation god, the blood and water that pours from his wound being equally replicated in the natural phenomenon of the Red River Adonis that flows down from the sacred shrine of the Faka High and the cedars of the Lebanon. His imprisonment within the birth, his imprisonment or birth from a tree, the resurrection, and all this in harmony with the rhythm of the cosmos, the cycle of nature, and the primal operations of alchemy. The Order of Templar Astartes is striving to revitalize this potent resource of eco-cultural mythocosmic synchronicities. Boy, that sounds like Fred Adams. Developing a cycle of seasonal ceremonies transmuted from the ancient Tyrian mysteries into poetic ritual dramas that will establish an ongoing magical power center which might be likened to one of Nikola Tesla's giant earth vibrating coils. And if the power and effects derived from the first Adonai are any indication of things to come, we expect the full cycle to be awesome. And I hope that Fred Osiris in Atlanta is listening, because of course his ceremonies are awesome. so we started. Ours were a little, ours were, yeah, a little bit awesome, but boy, that last one he did was awesome. Anyway, we're just about out of time. So what I would like to do is remind you that next week we will be finishing up Prince Akkad and the Magic Bow. And we are, I mentioned King Kurt, King Kurta. There's two ways to say that, Kurta or King Kurt. Nobody can figure out which one is right. You know, you have to realize that there were no vowels in ancient Ugaritic script. So you kind of have to put your vowels wherever you want them. I'll read you just the first part of this. Kurta, king of Bit Habur. Ruined was the house of the king who once had seven brothers, eight sons of one mother. Kurta, our patriarch, was destroyed. Kurta's dynasty was finished. His legal wife went away, his lawful spouse.
And the woman he married left him, and he had descendants, but three died in childbirth, one of disease. One, Repesh, one the plague, gathered to himself. But Repesh the plague was a minor demon, gathered to himself, and the sixth was lost at sea, and the seventh fell in battle.
Kurta saw his offspring destroyed, his royal house completely finished, his line utterly ruined, and he had no heir in his household. He entered his room and wept. He repeated his words and shed tears. His tears flowed like shekels to the ground. Like fifth shekels onto his bed, and he wept and fell asleep. As he shed tears, he had a dream. Sleep overpowered him, and he lay down. But his dream made him restless. For in his dream, El came down. In his vision, the father of men approached and asked Kurta, "Why are you weeping, Kurta? Why does the gracious one, the lad of El, shed tears?" And so you can imagine why. I don't know why El doesn't know that. He ought to. But anyway, we're going to put King Kurta into the same modern framework as we have Prince Akkad the Magic Bow. So tune in next week, and we'll finish up Prince Akkad and the Magic Bow, and after that we will have another new show. And at that point, we'll be back with you. But be sure and tune in. We'll finish up Prince Akkad and the Magic Bow. Meanwhile, good magic.